Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. In today's podcast, we talk about six of the presentations that were held at the annual meeting of the European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology, or the EADV Congress 2023, which was held in Berlin, Germany, from the 11th through the 14th of October, 2023. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
We're going to start off looking at women with psoriasis and whether systemic therapy actually helps or not. This was a lecture by Dr. Fabio Ferrardi from the University Hospital of Zurich in Switzerland. And Dr. Ferrardi talked about the long-term conventional systemic therapies in psoriasis and whether or not they could lead to higher drug-related adverse events and treatment discontinuation rates compared with biologics. He started off by describing, quote, "We investigated the safety of systematic psoriasis therapies employing sex stratification in assessing drug toxicity to enable the customization of treatment plans." Dr. Ferrardi and his team conducted the comprehensive analysis using the Swiss Psoriasis Registry, SDNTT, retrieving 10-year data from patients with moderate to severe psoriasis receiving conventional systemic therapies or biologics. They calculated adverse events rates per 100 patient years and used descriptive statistics to assess whether patients and disease have certain characteristics. They also compared treatment groups and sex-specific differences using binomial and t-tests to gain valuable safety insights. So the eligible patients in that current study, there were 791 of them, had a mean age of 46 years, and 37% of them, or 290, were women. Moreover, 45% received conventional systemic therapies, or CSTs, while 55% underwent biologic treatments. The study showed that the patients who received conventional systemic therapies, or CST, had a 2.2-fold higher adverse event rate and an 8.0-fold higher treatment discontinuation rate than those who were under biologic therapy. Those are all highly significant findings. Further analysis revealed a higher cumulative adverse event rate for both treatments in women, with 1.8-fold for CSTs and 2.0-fold increase for biologics. In general, the women receiving CSTs, except for apremilast and cyclosporin, experienced a higher rate of adverse events and discontinuation rates as a consequence. So Dr. Ferrardi said, quote, "Patients with psoriasis undergoing CST develop more drug-related adverse events than those receiving biologics. Also, the drug toxicity, especially in CST, is sex-associated and higher in women." He further emphasized the importance of integrating sex stratification in therapeutic decision-making when managing patients with psoriasis. So this is a decade of insights from the Swiss Psoriasis Registry, and I think we learned something here about gender-specific preferences. Now, what about botanical drug solutions and whether that can improve the hair regrowth in children and adolescents with alopecia areata, or AA, in the rest of this talk? This was a presentation by Professor Ulrike Blume-Peitavi from the Charité Hospital in Berlin, Germany, and it was really talking about the Rainbow Trial. So the botanical drug solution, which is called Coacilium. It's a 22.25% solution. It contains extracts of lemon, onion, cocoa, and guarana. And this drug reduces pro-inflammatory adhesion molecules, thus counteracting the immune privilege collapse typical for AA, and it also has an effect on the apoptotic pathway. That was the rationale that was underlying the assessment for efficacy and safety of this particular solution in children and adolescents with moderate to severe AA. It was a twice-daily treatment, and it contained only plant extracts, and the question was whether this could lead to sustained hair regrowth in children and adolescents with AA. This was a phase 2-3 Rainbow trial with AARAAINBOW, presented again, like I said, by Professor Blume-Peitavi, and it's a randomized, double-blind, multi-center phase 2-3 trial. It included patients between the ages of 2 and 18 years old with a severity of alopecia tool or SALT score between 20 and 50, corresponding to moderate AA, and 50 to 95, which is considered severe AA. And the participants were randomly assigned to the botanical solution at 22.5% twice daily or placebo, and then treated for 24 weeks. And this period was followed by a treatment washout period of 24 weeks to evaluate disease relapse after treatment discontinuation. At 24 weeks, 62 participants with an average age of about 11 years old could be analyzed, and there were 42 in the intervention arm and 20 in the placebo arm. Treatment with the botanical solution led to the primary endpoint of a mean change in SALT score of 22.9% in the coacilium group versus minus 8% in the placebo group, and that was a significant p-value. Moreover, 26.2% in the coacilium group achieved a 40% relative reduction in SALT after 24 weeks of treatment compared with 5% in the placebo group. So efficacy was positively correlated with an improvement in quality of life, not too surprisingly. Interestingly, the SALT score of the botanical solution treated participants continued to improve after treatment discontinuation from 44 to 29. And after discontinuation, 82% of the participants treated with the botanical solution experienced hair growth after treatment discontinuation. At week 48, almost half the participants of 47% in the intervention arm reached SALT scores of less than or equal to 20 compared with 9.1% in the placebo group. Again, a significant p-value. Overall, the solution was totally well tolerated, and there were only local, transient, mild, or very moderate side effects, except for one case of severe transient eczema that stopped after treatment discontinuation and was therefore easily manageable. Really interesting work, and hopefully inexpensive and easy to apply globally. Great work. Moving on to topical tapinarof. Is it a rising star in atopic dermatitis? I think that's the question. This was a talk about the phase 3 ADORING 1 and ADORING 2 trials. It was held by Dr. Jonathan Silverberg from the George Washington University School of Medicine in the United States. And these are phase 3 results of tapinarof cream and what its potential might be as a new agent for treating atopic dermatitis from an early age. The identical phase 3 trials ADORING 1 and ADORING 2 investigated tapinarof as a treatment for AD. Included were 813 adult and pediatric participants aged 2 years or older, and the mean age of the participants was about 16 years, with about 20% in the age group of 2 to 6 years old. Most participants had moderate disease, and all others had somewhat more severe disease. They were treated for over 8 weeks with either once daily tapinarof cream at 1% or a vehicle. After 2 months, significantly higher proportions of participants in the tapinarof arms in both studies reached the primary endpoint of 0 or 1 in the VIGA-AD score, with 45.4% and 46.4% versus 13.9% and 18% respectively on the placebo arm. That was pretty significant for both comparisons. Similarly, the results for the secondary endpoint of EASI-75 in the ADORING 1 and 2 were 55.8% and 22.9% versus 59.1% against the 21.2%. So that's highly repeatable. In addition, a greater than or equal to 4-point decrease in the peak pruritus numerical rating scale, or the PPNRS, was detected in favor of tapinarof in both trials. So that's pretty convincing. Folliculitis, headache, and nasopharyngitis were the most common adverse events with a rate of greater than or equal to 5%. Dr. Silverberg described the study drug as being overall well tolerated with a predictable safety profile, also referring to existing large experience from already FDA-approved indication for psoriasis. He concluded, quote, "The take-home message is that tapinarof is a novel, non-steroidal, topical medication that has the potential to be used for the treatment of atopic dermatitis in patients all the way down to 2 years without restrictions on duration, extent, or sites of application." It's kind of a breakthrough. Really nice work. So we wanted to catch up on the continuing povorcitinib treatment in an open extension period over a 6-month double-blind phase trial. This was presented by Professor Khaled Ezzedine from the University of Paris East in Créteil, France. And this is a really interesting look at whether this trial actually results in additional repigmentation in a considerable percentage of participants. And this is a phase 2b trial, and what some of the side effects might be was also, of course, really important to understand. The JAK1 inhibitor, povorcitinib, it was tested as a treatment for non-segmental vitiligo in a phase 2b trial, and it enrolled 171 patients. And for equally powered study arms, the participants were treated with three different dosages of povorcitinib, so either 15 milligrams, 45 milligrams, 75 milligrams, or they got placebo once daily over 24 weeks. Thereafter, all participants starting on this regimen were continued on 45 milligrams, and all other participants received 75 milligrams of the study drug for 28 more weeks, which was followed by 6 months of off-treatment follow-up. The median age of participants was 50 years, and 54.4% were women. Vitiligo was diagnosed at a mean of 19.4 years previous to the start of the study. At week 24, the change in total body vitiligo area scoring index, or VASI, was significantly higher in all povorcitinib groups than on placebo, with at least a square mean depigmentation improvements of 19.1%, 17.8%, and 15.7%, compared with a reduction in pigmentation of 2.3% for the participants that were on the placebo arm. This was highly significant, of course, and all comparisons were made to placebo. Up to week 52, the results further advanced to 42.7% and 41.3% in those that were on the 45 milligram and 75 milligram povorcitinib from the start. Professor Ezzedine said, quote, "Even at week 52, we haven't reached the plateau. This is something very interesting." And he pointed out that the VASI 50 was achieved in 15.2% on the 45 milligrams after 6 months and 37.0% at week 52. With regard to facial VASI, statistical significance was also present in all regimens of povorcitinib, with the highest rate on the continued 45 milligrams from day one. And so that was 36.4% versus 5.1% in the placebo arm at week 24. And after 1 year, that was 63.8%. So the facial VASI 75 was observed at 45.5 to 58.6% at the end of the extension period. Professor Ezzedine also explained that although the sample size for the period without treatment from the weeks 52 to 76 was really too small for a robust statistical analysis, the results did suggest a maintained durability of response in both facial and total body repigmentation. Safety, of course, is always important, and with regard to safety at week 52, the overall rate of treatment-emergent adverse events on the povorcitinib was reported to be 89.3%, where only those that were grade 3 or higher was at 16.9%, and really serious was at 2.4%. Professor Ezzedine commented, quote, "No serious adverse events were considered related to the treatment, and no new safety signals were observed." So the conclusion was that its povorcitinib is generally well tolerated at all doses and certainly seems to have a great efficacy in the repigmenting in extensive vitiligo. This next talk was about remibrutinib and whether it can reduce itch, improve sleep, and kind of help with the activity impairment in patients with chronic spontaneous urticaria. This was a talk presented by Dr. Ana Jiménez-Arnau from the Autonomous University and Pompeu Fabra University in Spain, and it's a phase 2 trial. This current analysis, which evaluated remibrutinib's performance on itch severity as well as interference of activity in sleep and within the framework of a phase 2b dose-finding study for patients with moderate to severe CSU. The 311 adult participants were randomized to receive treatment with placebo or six different dosing regimens of remibrutinib, ranging from 10 milligrams once daily to 100 milligrams twice daily over 12 weeks on a background medication with antihistamines. Assessment tools of the novel analysis were weekly results in itch severity score, or the ISS-7 tool, sleep interference score, or the SIS-7 score, and the activity interference score, so AIS-7 score. The baseline characteristics of the participants included a mean age of 45 years, and 71.4% were women. there was a CSU presence of about 4.9 years, so about 5 years patients had been really dealing with this disease. Mean values for ISS7, SIS7, and AIS7 at the start of the trial varied between 12.6 to 14.6, 10.2 to 12.2, and 10.5 to 13.1, respectively, for the different remibrutinib doses, while corresponding measures in the placebo group were 11.8, 10.3, and 10.8. So pretty much baseline was good. At week 2, itch reductions in the ISS7 on any regimen of the drug ranged from 6.3 to 9.5, compared with 1.1 on the placebo arm. After 12 weeks, the values for reduction were in a similar range. And at 3 months, we saw that 26.7 to 46.5% of the participants attained an ISS7 of 0, meaning that they had no itch, compared with 19% with an ISS7 of 0 in the placebo arm. So that's pretty good. At least a doubling. Likewise, the SIS7 findings decreased between 5.2 and 8.6 in the remibrutinib arms, compared with 1.3 in the placebo arm at week 2, compared with 2.9 at week 12, respectively. Already at week 2, the participants without sleep interference was 39.4 to 44.2%, so about 40% of the different things, and that was compared to 12.5% on placebo, so really great impact on sleep interference. Participants were treated with the remibrutinib also reached less impairment of activity than the ones receiving placebo, indicating by changes of the AIS-7 of minus 5.2 to minus 9.1 on the remibrutinib arms, and it was only 1.8 to 3.0 on the placebo reductions. In the other measures, the proportions reaching of AIS-7 of 0 were also superior across all remibrutinib doses in contrast to placebo. So in general, I think we can indicate that the phase 3 assessment for remibrutinib and CSU, it's really already underway and fully justified by this data. Really gorgeous. There was lots of great news about psoriasis at this meeting, and Professor Bruce Strober from the Yale University School of Medicine in Connecticut, the United States, did not fail to present more excellent data with regard to psoriasis. This study was looking at the differential effect of biologics for psoriasis on the risk of developing arthritis, which remains a real problem in the field. So this had 7,144 biologic-naive patients with psoriasis, and it looked at therapy with IL-23 blockers and whether it had a lower risk of developing inflammatory arthritis or psoriatic arthritis. Professor Strober started off by saying, quote, approximately a quarter of psoriasis patients will develop inflammatory arthritis or psoriatic arthritis. But does the risk of inflammatory arthritis or PSA actually get delayed by the type of biologic therapy that patients are treated with? And that was really the objective of this study. The patients included in this analysis were enrolled in the Optum Clinformatics Data Mart, or CDM, database between January of 2014 and December of 2022, with two ICD-9 or ICD-10 diagnosis codes for psoriasis. Biologic-naive participants were assigned to four cohorts based on the biologic they received first, so it was either IL-23, IL-17, an IL-12/23 blocker, or TNF inhibitors. All participants were followed up to 3 years until inflammatory arthritis developed, and that was defined by those diagnostic codes, or until participants switched or discontinued their biologics or lost a follow-up, and whichever occurred first. A total of 7,345 biologic-naive participants were included in the analysis. 2,712 were treated with an IL-23 blocker, 1,078 with an IL-12 and 23 blocker, 811 with an IL-17 blocker, and 2,744 were in the TNF cohort. Participants receiving IL-23 for psoriasis had numerically lower incidence of inflammatory arthritis and psoriatic arthritis. When compared to participants receiving IL-23 inhibitors, participants receiving IL-17 or TNF inhibitors were significantly more likely to develop inflammatory arthritis. For the development of psoriatic arthritis, a significant difference was only seen when compared with TNF inhibitors. Professor Strober, however, emphasized that there is a bias of potential limitation in this study because, as healthcare professionals may have preferentially prescribed IL-23 blockers to participants with early markers of psoriatic arthritis. And therefore, the current results really do need to be backed up by additional studies regarding the impact of the biologics on the future risk of arthritis in these patients. Fantastic work. That's it for this podcast. I hope you learned something, and it was a great conference. And stay safe and stay healthy. Until next time.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.